Our sermon passage this morning comes from Matthew chapter 24. The book of Matthew can be found at the beginning of the New Testament. Please turn there with me and follow along as I read Matthew 24, 1 through 44. Stand for the reading of God's word. Jesus left the temple and was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. But he answered them, "You see all these, do you not? Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." As he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" And Jesus answered them, "See that no one leads you astray, for many will come in my name saying, 'I am the Christ,' and they will lead many astray, and you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are but the beginning of the birth pains. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what is in his house, and let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days, pray that your flight may not be in winter or on a Sabbath, for then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Then if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'There he is,' do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders, so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, 'Look, he is in the wilderness,' do not go out. If they say, 'Look, he is in the inner rooms,' do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, you know that he is near, at the very gates. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father only. For as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day when Noah entered the ark, and they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken and one left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and one left. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect." This is the word of the Lord. You may be seated.
88 reasons the rapture will be in 1988. The end. Have a great day. That's the name of a book that Edward Wisnott wrote in January of 1988. It went on to become a bestseller in that year, selling approximately 4.5 million copies. And as the title suggests, the book gives 88 reasons for why the rapture will be in 1988. Specifically, sometime between September 11th and September 13th, which was the Jewish holiday Rosh Hashanah. So Wisnott was so convinced by these reasons and the date that he gave in this book that he wrote, and I quote, "Only if the Bible is an error am I wrong. If there were a king in this country and I could gamble with my life, I would stake my life on Rosh Hashanah 88. Well, as you know, 1988 came, but Jesus didn't. Instead, another year went, and another year passed, and Jesus never came. And so I don't know about you, but it's easy, kind of like what I'm doing, to laugh and kind of poke fun of those who predict dates for Jesus's return and the rapture and all those things. It's easy to do. It's an easy target. But do you know what's just as bad or maybe even worse than setting a date and predicting a date for when Jesus is going to return? It's being ambivalent about his return or not even thinking about his return in any way, shape, or form. And that's one of the purposes and points of our passage that we're going to see this morning. That our passage this morning has something to say to both of these extremes, to both of these groups. It has something to say to those on this extreme who have this unhealthy fixation on signs and the newspaper and trying to figure out when Jesus is going to return and come back. For those people, our passage is going to tell you and exhort you to put down your newspaper and quit being overly fixated on trying to identifying all these different signs which supposedly indicate Jesus' return. But to those on the other extreme, meaning those who hardly even think about Jesus' return, that Jesus' return is not even on your radar, it's not even anything you really even give much time a day to even think about, then our passage this morning is going to exhort you to be prepared for Jesus' return. To be ready to think about it, to have the reality of his return be on your mind and to filter down to affect how you live in your everyday life. So before we jump into this passage here this morning, chapter 24 here, like Jared said, it's a somewhat tricky passage. And so it's important to remember then the context and kind of where we left off last week in chapter 23. So if you remember in chapter 23, kind of the main chunk that we saw there were seven woes of judgment that Jesus pronounced on the Jewish political and religious leaders of his day. That if you remember that Jesus came as the promised Messiah king from the line of David, and these Jewish leaders, they rejected him. They saw him, they didn't recognize that he was the promised son of David, and therefore they rejected him, they conspired against him. And as a result then, Jesus pronounced then these seven woes of judgment upon them in chapter 23. In our passage this morning then, here's what Jesus is going to do. He pronounces these woes of judgment. And now in chapter 24, he's going to give a detailed description of what this judgment is going to look like. He's going to give a detailed description of what this judgment is going to entail and what it's going to consist of that's going to fall on these Jewish religious leaders and Israel itself. And as he describes and gives this detailed description of this judgment that they're going to face, then you and I are going to learn some pretty important truths about the future and about Jesus' coming and about the end of the age. And as we're confronted and see these truths about the future and Jesus is coming, then I pray that it will help to give us a right perspective and a right understanding of how to think about them. And so let's dive into Matthew 24 here, and we're going to be moving at light speed, okay? This is going to be like running commentary through a lot of Matthew 24, putting all the application at the very end. And because of that, you got to listen really, really fast. Everybody with me? Okay, Matthew 24. Jesus begins with this shocking pronouncement in verses 1 and 2. And so look at verse 1 with me. Here's the shocking pronouncement that Jesus begins chapter 24 with. Verse 1. Jesus left the temple and was going away. And when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple, but he answered them, "You see all these, do you not? Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." So then, immediately after Jesus makes these, pronounces these seven woes of judgment in chapter 23, he and his disciples leave the temple, and on his way out of the temple to the Mount of Olives, he makes this shocking pronouncement. He tells the disciples that this temple, meaning this huge monstrosity of a temple that could fit like 12 football fields in, and that some of these stones of the temple were 20 feet long, like a monstrosity, humongous temple. Jesus says, "Hey, disciples, see that temple? It's all coming down. It's going to be demolished. It's going to be a pile of rubble." And when the disciples heard that, their minds were just, "No way, that thing's coming down. How's that going to happen?" And just blew their mind. And because of that, then they had some questions to ask Jesus. And we see their questions in the very next verse there in verse 3. Look at verse 3. Matthew goes on to write. He says, "As he," talking about Jesus, "sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be? And what would be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?'" So it's important to notice here, the disciples ask Jesus two questions here. The first question they ask is, when will these things be? These things, and that's really important, remember those two words. These things are specifically a reference to the destruction of the temple. They want to know when that's going to happen. When is the temple going to come tumbling down? Secondly, though, the second part of their question, they want to know what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age, which is one question, because the coming of Jesus means the end of the age. But something important to note there is that that word coming in verse 3 is the Greek word parousia, and it's the technical word that the Bible uses for the second coming of Christ. Tuck that away. That's really important too. So that's the twofold question that the disciples ask there in verse 3. In the rest of chapter 24 then, and then even all the way into chapter 25, Jesus is going to answer their twofold question with the twofold answer. And here's how he's going to do it. And this is really important. In verse 4 through verse 35, he's going to answer the disciples' first question about when the destruction of the temple is going to happen. And then in verse 36, all the way through the end of chapter 25, he's going to answer the disciples' second question about what the sign of Jesus' coming is and the end of the age and what that sign's going to be. And the reason we know, or let me say one of the reasons we know, that this is how Jesus is structuring his answer to the disciples' question is because of something that Jesus says at the very end of his answer to the disciples' first question that we see in verse 34. Look at verse 34 and what Jesus says at the end of his answer to the disciples' first question. Verse 34. Jesus says, "Truly I say to you," and who's the "you" here? The "you" here is the disciples. "Truly I say to you, this generation," those two words, "this generation," is found 11 times in the Gospel of Matthew, and every single time it's used, it's always used in the same exact way. It's always referring to that present generation that Jesus is talking to when Jesus is alive, that Jesus is speaking to, that present generation. And so Jesus tells his disciples, "I say to you," my disciples, this generation will not pass away until all, and here comes our words again, these things take place. And so the obvious question is, what are these things in verse 34? Well, remember the first question the disciples asked Jesus all the way back in verse 3. They asked, when will these things be? Meaning the destruction of the temple. And so then that's what Jesus is doing in verse 4 through verse 35 here. He's answering the disciples' first question about when these things, the destruction of the temple, is going to happen. In verse 36 then, of chapter 24, look there, we see Jesus shift the topic. And he says, but concerning that day and hour. So he's shifting the topic here. He says, but concerning that day and hour, meaning that day and hour of Jesus' coming and of the end of the age, that's going to be his focus and the question that he's going to answer, starting in verse 36 all the way through the end of chapter 25. And the reason I start off with that and make it such a big deal of that is because it's really important to understand which question of the disciples Jesus is answering, because if we're not careful, we can think that verses 4 through 35 are giving us signs of Jesus' second coming, the second question the disciples asked, when in reality, verses 4 through 35 are giving the signs which indicate the temple is about to be destroyed, which is the first question that Jesus asked. And as we're about to see, which was destroyed almost 2,000 years ago in 70 AD, during that generation of the disciples, just like he said in verse 34. So, let's dive into verses 4 through 35 and see in more detail Jesus' answer to the first question the disciples asked about when the temple is going to be destroyed. He begins his answer in verse 4 through verse 14 by describing these different warning signs, these specific events that are going to lead up to, over a period of time and over a period of years, lead up to the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. So look at verse 4 with me. Matthew writes, "And Jesus answered them, 'See that no one leads you astray, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and they will lead many astray. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are but the beginning of the birth pains. Then they will deliver you to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations. And then the end will come.'" So what Jesus is saying here is that these are the initial events that are going to take place over a period of time, over a period of years, that are going to eventually lead up to the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. They're what Jesus calls here birth pains in verse 8, meaning they're the initial, beginning, preliminary pains and suffering that his disciples are going to experience, that his disciples are going to walk through, that his disciples are going to see. But the actual birth, meaning the actual destruction of the temple, is still a ways off. It's still a ways down the road. Which is what Jesus is getting at if you look at the end of verse 6 when he says, "But the end is not yet." That word "end" there at the end of verse 6 is a reference to the end of the temple, meaning the destruction of the temple. It's not a reference to the end of the age that the disciples asked about in verse 3. And the reason we know that is because the word "end" in verse 6 and also the word "end" in verse 14 is a different Greek word than the word end in verse 3 that the disciples were asking about when they were asking about the end of the age. And so then these are the warning signs then that the disciples, just telling the disciples that they need to be ready for, that are going to proceed, that are going to lead to the destruction of the temple. That, again, they don't mean that the destruction of the temple is imminent, like it's going to happen any moment. It's just, here's the preliminary birth pains. They're just the preliminary events that leads to the destruction of the temple. And of all these labor pains that are mentioned here in verse 4 through 14, probably the one that's the most confusing, that raises the most questions, is in verse 14. Look there, the one that says the gospel will be proclaimed throughout the whole world and then the end will come. This is a verse that many will point to and say, see there? These verses can't be referring to events that took place during the generation of Jesus' disciples that led up to the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. Because obviously the gospel has been proclaimed throughout the whole world, because if it had, then the end would have come. And the end hasn't come. And therefore, this can't be a reference to that specific being accomplished within that specific generation. Well, there's a few important things to mention in response to that. And first would be, when Jesus talks in verse 14 about the whole world, that's the language he uses there, we see that same language, the whole world, throughout the Bible, in reference to the known world, the known inhabited world, oftentimes specifically in reference to the Roman Empire. And so one example of this is we see Paul use this same language in Colossians chapter 1, verse 6, when he tells the Colossian believers that the gospel has come to you, as indeed in the whole world it is bearing fruit. Paul doesn't mean by that that the gospel is bearing fruit in China and Japan and the Amazon rainforest and everywhere else in between in the world at that moment. And so what he means is it's bearing fruit in the known world, in the known inhabited world as the people understood it then. Again, probably a reference to the Roman Empire. We see Paul use the same language in Romans chapter 1, verse 8. We see this same language even used in Luke chapter 2, verse 1. And so the picture here is that during the time of Paul, he, as he's writing to the Colossian believers, he could even write in Colossians 1, 6, that the gospel had been preached to the whole world and is bearing fruit in the whole world. Again, meaning the known inhabited world at that specific point in time. Which according to Jesus in verse 14 was one of the events, one of the warning signs that would precede and lead to the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. In verses 15 through 28 then, Jesus is going to transition from talking about the events that are leading up to the destruction of the temple to talking about the events that are going to signal the imminent destruction of the temple. In other words, when Jesus' disciples see these events that he's about to mention, then they know the destruction of the temple is getting really, really, really close. They'll know that the destruction of the temple, it's imminent. And we see the events that he mentions there starting in verse 15. Look there with me. Jesus says, so when you see, again, you is reference to the disciples. It's not a reference to you and me. It's a reference to the disciples. When you, disciples, see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. And so then the abomination of desolation, that phrase there is a phrase that Jesus mentions three times in the Old Testament book of Daniel. In Daniel chapter 9, in Daniel chapter 11, and in Daniel chapter 12. And in Daniel chapter 11, verse 31, Daniel prophesied of a day in which the temple would be deceived the temple would be desecrated by a pagan king. And almost everyone in that day would agree, and most scholars today, that Daniel's prophecy in Daniel chapter 11, verse 31, about the temple being desecrated by a pagan king, that was fulfilled in 167 BC. when Antiochus Epiphanes marched into the temple with his army, set up a statue of Zeus, and sacrificed a pig on the altar. Like, that's not make-believe. Like, that literally happened. It was an abomination that caused desolation. And so then, in verse 15 here, Jesus picks up on this same language from Daniel. And Jesus says that just like in Daniel's day, there's going to be another even greater desecration of the temple that is going to happen in the lifetime of his disciples leading up to the destruction of the temple. And there was one. That in 70 AD, the emperor Titus laid siege to the city of Jerusalem. He entered the city with the Roman army. He entered into the temple. He desecrated it just like Antiochus Epiphanes did. And then he completely demolished it. And Jesus is saying, disciples, you, when you see this, and the Jesus's, or the parallel account in Luke chapter 21 gives us even more description of this. When the disciples see the Roman armies approaching Jerusalem to lay siege to it, to desecrate the temple, and to demolish it, when they see the big bad Roman army coming up, then in verses 16 through 22 here, Jesus tells his disciples what to do. And you know what he tells them what to do? You know what he tells them to do? He tells them to run. Like, run. Hightail it out of there as quick as you can. Don't go back trying to grab something or just don't go as fast as you can. Get out of there and flee to the mountains for safety. And the reason he tells them to do that is because that's how barbaric and horrific and deadly the Roman invasion and destruction of Jerusalem and the temple is going to be. I had a bunch of quotes and everything else from Josephus, but don't have any time for any of that, just of how awful it was. And so he's like, get out of there. Run. In verse 23 then, Jesus gives another warning, another sign to his disciples that it's going to be happening right around the imminent destruction of the temple. Verse 23, he warns them about not being deceived by false messiahs, false Christ during this time. Look at verse 23. He says, if anyone says to you, look, here's the Christ, or there he is, don't believe it. For false Christ and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, look, he is in the wilderness, do not go out. If they say, look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming, and that's the coming there's parousia, that's our word from verse 3, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. So the reason Jesus' disciples don't need to be deceived into believing those who say, the Messiah's in the wilderness, the Messiah's over here, the Messiah's over there, the Messiah's over here. The reason they don't need to listen and believe any of that is because when the Messiah comes, when he comes a second time, it will be as clear as day. It will be evident and obvious for everyone to see. In verse 27, he says, it will be like lightning that fills the sky from the east all the way to the west. Like, you won't be able to miss it. It's going to be obvious. Like, it'll be there. It won't be hidden in secrecy. You don't have to go out and find it. It'll be obvious for everyone to see. No one will miss it. And so when they see these events, the abomination of desolation, the Roman armies approaching Jerusalem, when they see more of these announcements about these false messiahs, then they know that the destruction of the temple is imminent. It's really, really close. Which then leads to the actual destruction of the temple, along with the exaltation and vindication of Jesus in the process. And this is what we see in verses 29 through 31. So I'll admit, and be the first one to admit, that of all the verses in chapter 24, none of them pale in comparison to verses 29 through 31 in terms of difficulty to interpret and understand. These are the hardest verses in chapter 24. They're the hardest verses in the book of Matthew. They might be the hardest verses in the entire New Testament. Many understand these verses, 29 through 31, to refer to the second coming of Jesus and the end of the age. But I and other New Testament scholars, so you don't think I'm just out here on an island by myself, believe that verses 29 through 31 here are still referring to events surrounding the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD and that are going to happen during the lifetime of the disciples. And I believe that for at least these two reasons. The first reason is because of what Jesus says in verse 34 again. Truly I say to you, this generation, which in Matthew all the time is that present generation that's alive during the time of Jesus, will not pass away until all these things take place. Again, meaning all the things he just mentioned, all the things he's mentioning in verse 4 through verse 31. Those are all the things that are going to take place. He's telling you what they are. Verses 4 through 31. And included in verses 4 through 31 is verses 29 through 31. So they're going to happen. The events in verse 29 through 31 are going to happen during the lifetime of the generation that Jesus is talking to. The other reason I believe these verses, verses 29 through 31, are going to take place during the lifetime of the disciples and as a reference to the destruction of the temple is because of how verse 29 begins. Look at verse 29. Jesus says, immediately after the tribulation of those days. So then this is when the events Jesus is about to describe in verses 29 through 31 are going to take place. They're going to take place immediately. That word immediately means immediately. Like, not trying to be funny, like it means right away. Doesn't mean a delay, doesn't mean a gap, it means right there, immediately. They're going to take place immediately, meaning right after the tribulation of those days. What days? Those days. Meaning the tribulation of those days that he just mentioned in verses 4 through 28. That throughout Matthew 24, Jesus is going to contrast, and this is really important, those days with that day. He's contrasting those two things all throughout Matthew 24. Those days is a reference to the events and days preceding and leading up to the destruction of the temple and all the affliction and suffering and tribulation that's going to take place. That's those days. That day is a reference to Jesus' second coming. Jesus is going to make that distinction, those days, that day, over and over again all throughout this chapter. And so when Jesus then says immediately after the tribulation of those days in verse 29, he means immediately after all the tribulation of the events that he just described in verses 4 through 28. That immediately after those events, here's what's going to happen. Look at verse 29. The sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall from heaven. And the powers of the heavens will be shaken. So again, at first glance, this language here seems like it's talking about Jesus' second coming and the end of the age. That's what it seems like. But if you dig deeper into the language that Jesus is using here, you'll notice that he's using the same exact language that the Old Testament prophets used when they spoke about a nation or a mighty power or an empire or a regime of some sort falling and being leveled to the ground in judgment. When that happened, they used the same sort of apocalyptic, cosmic language about suns and moons and stars and all those things to describe the downfall of mighty powers and superpowers and nations. We see this over and over again all throughout the Old Testament prophets and the prophetic books in the Old Testament. Like, here's one example, Isaiah chapter 13, verse 10. This is going to sound exactly like Matthew 24, 29. In Isaiah 13, 10, it says, "For the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark at its rising, and the moon will not shed its light." Again, almost the exact same language as Matthew 24, 29. But do you know what Isaiah is describing here? The fall of Babylon. We see the same language being used in Ezekiel 32 in reference to the judgment and the downfall of Egypt. We see the same language in Joel chapter 2 in reference to the judgment and the downfall of Edom, and over again throughout the Old Testament prophets. And this is the language that Jesus, the final ultimate prophet, then uses to describe the destruction and the downfall of Jerusalem and Israel and the temple. Look then at what he says in verse 30. He says, "Then," or that could also be translated as "at that time, will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man." Many translations, that's how the ESV translates that. Many translations translates the first part of verse 30 as, "Then will appear the sign of the Son of Man who is in heaven." That translation better reflects not only the word order in the original language, but it also indicates that the Son of Man is the one in heaven, not the sign. Instead, the sign is what just took place in verse 29. The downfall, the destruction, the judgment of the temple. And look what happens then when they see this sign. When they see the temple's destruction. Look at verse 30. "Then all the tribes of the earth will mourn." You see the word tribes there? That word occurs 31 times in the New Testament. And every single time it's used in the New Testament, it's always, 100% of the time, used in reference to the tribes of Israel. And that's how it's being used here. The tribes of the earth, or that word earth could also be translated as the word land. The tribes of the land. Meaning when the temple is destroyed, the tribes of the land, the tribes of Israel are going to, they're going to weep. They're going to mourn. Keep going on in verse 30 then. "And they," meaning the tribes of Israel, "will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory." And so then it's tempting in verse 30 here to see the word "coming" here and think that Jesus is referring to his second coming. And in doing so, he's answering the second question the disciples asked in verse 3 about the sign of his coming. But one of the reasons we know that's not what Jesus is doing here and what Jesus is talking about here is because the word translated as "coming" in verse 30 isn't the Greek word parousia, which is the technical word in the Bible for Jesus' second coming that he used in verse 3 and also in verse 27. Instead, the word "coming" in verse 30 is just a basic general word for coming and going and moving from here to there. Not only that, but the other reason we know that verse 30 isn't referring to Jesus' second coming is because almost all scholars would agree that in verse 30 here, Jesus is quoting from the Old Testament book of Daniel, specifically Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14, which is a record of a vision that Daniel received. And we've seen this vision all throughout the book of Matthew, but I'm going to read it for you. Here's a description of the vision that Daniel saw in Daniel 7, verses 13 through 14. Daniel says, "I saw in the night visions, and behold, Same language here is what we're going to see in verse 30 of Matthew 24. And behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. So what Jesus is quoting in verse 30 here of Matthew 24. But the point you need to see here and notice here is that in Daniel chapter 7, the Son of Man doesn't come riding on the clouds down to earth, meaning the second coming. Instead, in Daniel 7, he rides on the clouds, not down to earth, but to the Ancient of Days in heaven, where he's given a throne and a kingdom and an everlasting dominion. And this is what the sign then of the temple's destruction in 70 AD signified to the tribes of Israel. That when the tribes of Israel saw and the destruction of the temple and the desolation of Jerusalem, it signified to them that Jesus was right. It signified to them that Jesus was who he said he was. That he really was the Messiah King from the line of David that God had promised, who they killed, but who was resurrected from the dead, ascended to heaven, and who is now enthroned in heaven, where he sits at God's right hand, reigning and ruling forever. And the reality of that made the tribes of Israel mourn and weep when they see the temple's destruction, because it signified to them and reminded them that instead of bowing their knee and worshiping Jesus for who he really was, they rejected him and had him killed. And as a result, now they're paying the consequences of it. The judgment of God has left their temple and their city in ruins. And as a result then, look what King Jesus is going to do in verse 31. We don't have time to spend a lot of time here, but, and he will send out his angels. The word angels there is messengers, with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. In other words, since Israel has been judged and condemned, Jesus now sends his messengers out to gather the elect from all the corners of the earth, not just Israel. And he does so with the gospel. Verse 31, in other words, is a preview of the Great Commission that's to come. So then, everybody still awake? Everybody with me? That's some hard stuff to understand and to make sense of. But let me summarize it. Jesus, in verse 29 through 31, is using Old Testament prophetic language to describe the destruction of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem. And he's describing Israel's recognition of his ultimate exaltation and vindication, which then finally leads to Jesus' specific answer to the disciples' question about when the temple is going to be destroyed. In other words, up to this point, he really hadn't answered their question. He's getting a bunch of general events, and here's what you can kind of be aware of, and warning signs that are going to lead up to the destruction of the temple, but he never tells them when. He never tells them exact time period yet, the when question. He hasn't answered that yet. Well, he does in verses 32 through 35. Look at verse 32. Jesus tells his disciples, from the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, there's the these things again, meaning all the events preceding the destruction of the temple in verses 4 through 28, then you know that he, and that word he there, in some of your translations, it's translated as the word it. It could be either of those, he or it. And within the context here, I think the word it is probably a better translation because it's a reference to the destruction of the temple, When you see all of these things, verses 4 through 28, then you know that it, the destruction of the temple, is near at the very gates. And then verse 34, he says, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things, again, verse 4 through 30, all those things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. So Jesus finally answers their question. This is when the temple is going to be destroyed. It's going to happen. It's going to be destroyed in this generation, the generation of the disciples that he's talking to at the moment. And guess what? It's exactly what happened. It's exactly what happened. Everything Jesus describes here, down to a T, everything he predicts here, everything he said that would happen, it happened. Famines, earthquakes, wars, persecution, the abomination of desolation, false messiahs, the destruction of the temple, Roman armies, desecration of the temple, all of that stuff, all of it happened. And all of it just didn't happen. All of it happened exactly when Jesus said it would happen, in that generation. In 70 AD. Starting in verse 36 then, Jesus is going to go on to answer the disciples' second question about what the sign of his coming is and what the end, sign of the end of the age is. And don't worry, this explanation and answer is going to be a lot quicker. Hopefully. So look at verse 36 with me. Jesus says, but concerning that day and hour, meaning the day and hour Jesus returns, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father only. For as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark. They were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken and one left. Two men will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and one left. Therefore, stay awake, for you don't know on what hour, what day your Lord is coming. But you know this, that if the master of the house had known what in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. And so do you see the contrast that Jesus is making here? Jesus is contrasting the destruction of the temple and his second coming and his return. And he's contrasting it in two ways. Number one, he's saying that unlike the destruction of the temple, the timing of Jesus' second coming is unknown. It's unknown. That when it comes to the destruction of the temple, the disciples have a general time frame for when the temple is going to be destroyed. It's going to happen within their generation. But when it comes to Jesus' return, nobody has a clue when that's going to happen. The angels don't even know. Verse 36 says that Jesus doesn't even know. Only the Father knows. He's the only one that knows. Not only that, but the other contrast he makes here is that unlike the destruction of the temple, there won't be any signs preceding Jesus' second coming. In other words, when it came to the destruction of the temple, Jesus gave all these warning signs. When you see this, 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 you'll know the temple's about to be destroyed. It's imminent and all that sort of stuff. When it comes to the second coming of Jesus, guess what? There aren't any signs. There's none. He's just going to put out of nowhere. There he is. No, you're not even going to see it coming. There's no advanced warning. There's no heads up. There's no, okay, this, that. Uh-uh. None of that. Instead, his return, it's sudden. It's unexpected. It could happen any day. It could happen any hour. It could happen any minute. It could happen any second. It could happen before I'm finished with this sermon. On the day that Jesus returns, there will be birthday parties and weddings and presentations being made at work and grass being mowed. And just like in the days of Noah, the flood of God's judgment will suddenly just be unleashed on the earth when Jesus returns. So those then are Jesus' twofold answers to the disciples' twofold question. When will the temple be destroyed? And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Those are his answers. Which then leads to three final applications for our lives. We're going to conclude with this. That in light of everything we've seen, what effect should any of this have on our lives today other than a nice history lesson about 70 AD? It's a good question. Three applications. First, based upon everything we've seen and what Jesus said in Matthew 24, it should cause us to trust everything that Jesus has ever said. You with me? Like based upon everything we've seen here, it should cause us to trust everything that Jesus has ever said. I mean, just think about what we've seen in chapter 24 here. Jesus told the future. Let me say that again. Jesus told the future. Like he told specific details about events that are like 40 years from when he talks about them. Not in some vague, general way, but like in specifics. And he's talked like this all throughout the Gospel of Matthew. Like he's not like all these other religious leaders and end time people who make all these claims that aren't verifiable. Instead, he says, there's going to be a coin in that fish's mouth. And guess what? There's a coin there. He says, I'm going to be betrayed. And he was. I'm going to die and rise. And he did. The temple is going to fall. And it did. I'm going to return one day. And you can bet your bottom dollar he's going to. Like, make no mistake about it. You and I, we can trust Jesus' word. And so the question to ask in your life right now is, where are you struggling to do that? Where are you struggling to trust Jesus' word right now in your life? Like, whatever area that might be, then let what we've seen in Matthew 24 and Jesus's and the reality of the confidence of Jesus' word that we've seen here increase the trustworthiness and the reliability of his word. Let that cause it to increase your assurance and confidence in every single word that Jesus has spoken in this book. Second application for our lives then is this. It's to be ready for Jesus to return in judgment. It's to be ready for Jesus to return in judgment. In other words, the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem that we've talked about, it's not meant to just be a little history lesson. Instead, it's meant to be for you and me a pointer. It's meant to be for you and me a preview of a greater and more ultimate judgment that is to come when Jesus finally returns. And it's to remind us that rejecting Jesus has eternal, horrific consequences. What that means then is this. If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, we're not playing games here. Like I want to urge you and plead with you to trust in Jesus. Trust, believe. Put your only hope in Jesus' death on the cross as the one and only way that you can be rescued and saved from the judgment that you deserve for your sins that will happen whenever Jesus suddenly appears on this earth. And that could happen at any moment. You have no idea when that's going to happen. That could happen 5 million years from now, and it could happen 5 seconds from now. And when it does happen, if you're not a Christian, then when it happens, you're going to stand before your Maker and give an account for every deed and every word that you've ever said. And if you're not trusting in Jesus at that moment as your only hope for being rescued from the judgment you deserve for your sins, then the judgment that God poured out on Jerusalem and the temple pales in comparison to the judgment that he's going to pour out on you. So trust in him, believe in him, repent of your sin, and trust in the death and the resurrection of Jesus as your only hope to save you from your sin. Third and final application then is this. It's that everything we've seen Jesus speak in chapter 24 should cause us to find great comfort in knowing that Jesus warns his disciples and us of what's to come. I didn't word that very well, but here's what I mean by that. That in the midst of all the judgment language in this chapter, in the midst of all the destruction language in this chapter, don't miss the loving care and tender affection that Jesus shows his disciples in this chapter. In other words, did you notice that? Did you catch that? That throughout this chapter, did you notice how Jesus is like, he's watching over his disciples? Did you notice how concerned he is about his disciples? Did you notice how concerned he is for their well-being, physically and also spiritually? Even days before he himself is going to go to a cross and be crucified and die. That in this chapter, yes, destruction is coming. In this chapter, yes, judgment is coming. But in the midst of all this judgment and destruction talk, you have Jesus watching over his disciples like a good shepherd and a good king and just saying to them, don't be deceived. Don't be misled. Yeah, you're going to be delivered up to tribulation, but don't be surprised by it. You're going to be hated by everyone for my name's sake, but just hang in there. Don't give up. Don't be discouraged by that. Instead, yeah, when you see this, like, run, get out of there, flee to the mountains. In the midst of famines and earthquakes and false messiahs and wars and persecutions and a big ferocious attacking armies, Jesus is concerned in watching out for his disciples that they would persevere through it all to the end. And guess what? He's doing the same thing for you and me if you're a Christian here this morning. That, yeah, in some ways we have no idea what the future holds. And as a result, because of that, the future can feel pretty overwhelming and daunting in a million different ways. But thankfully, as we walk through whatever we're going to walk through in the future, we have a king who is reigning and ruling and watching over us. We have a good king who is watching out for us and over us, who is sovereign over all things, and who will ensure that you and I, if we're trusting in Jesus, will persevere to the very, very end. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your word. Thank you for hard passages of scripture that cause us to dig, to wrestle with the text, to wrestle with flows of thought, to wrestle with how words are used and how they're not used and all that sort of stuff. So thank you for that. Lord, I pray that the things that we've been confronted with this morning, that it would change and help our understanding and perspective when it comes to your word, that we'd have a greater confidence in your word, that it causes us to live with a greater expectation and readiness for the return of Jesus, and that it causes us to have great comfort as we walk through all the mess and the brokenness of the world in which we live to the very, very end, knowing that we have a good king who's watching over us. And we pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.